the second greatest event in human history. I'm referring to the Chinese Revolution of 1949. And for us, for Marxists, this was the second greatest event in human history after the Russian Revolution of 1917. Why do I say this? Well, the Russian Revolution was for the first time in Russia. The Russian workers overthrew landlordism and capitalism, and at least they started the process of the socialist transformation of society. How that ended up is another matter, but at least they started it. The results are there for all to see. Now, China before 1949 was an extremely backward, semi-colonial and semi-feudal country. The working class was a tiny minority. There wasn't much industrial development, only in certain areas. The big majority of the population were peasants. And the Chinese people as a whole was dominated by imperialism, subject to a humiliating domination by the main imperialist plunderers, Britain, France, Japan, United States, Russia, in the past, and so on. And all that changed in 1949. Now, it's interesting to see the process whereby this took place, because there was a difference, a fundamental difference, between what happened in Russia in the October Revolution of 1917 and what occurred in China in 1949. The Russian Revolution was a classical proletarian revolution carried out under the leadership of the Bolshevik Party, in which the working class took power and exercised power, at least in the first period, through the democratic rule of the Soviets, workers' councils. The Chinese Revolution was not a classical proletarian revolution at all. Mao Zedong, at the head of the Chinese Communist Party, or Stalinist Party, based itself on a peasant army, which he used as a battering ram to destroy the old regime, the old capitalist landlord regime. And incidentally, I will deal with this later on, but Mao's original program was not socialism at all. His original program was actually based on the idea of 100 years of capitalism. Wasn't going to touch the capitalist system. It was based upon the bourgeois democratic idea, fundamentally the national independence and land to the peasants, an agrarian revolution, which is the classical, two of the classical tasks of the bourgeois democratic revolution. Nevertheless, Mao Zedong ended up by expropriating the bourgeoisie, expropriating the capitalists. And China, therefore, not only broke with imperialism, but also broke with capitalism, which laid the basis for a colossal development of China in the subsequent period. Now, how does one explain this? How do you explain the peculiar way in which the Chinese Revolution developed? Well, before we enter into that question, I think we should first ask ourselves, what is the theory of the permanent revolution, which really is the only thing that can explain both the Russian Revolution and the Chinese Revolution? This was a brilliant theory. The permanent revolution was worked out by Trotsky quite early on, in 1904-1905, when he came to analyze the processes of the Russian Revolution. Now, you must bear firmly in mind that Tsarist Russia, Russia before the Russian Revolution, was very similar to China in many respects. Tsarist Russia also was a semi-feudal economy, and also it was largely dependent on foreign capital, although it wasn't formally a semi-colony. China was a semi-colony. Tsarist Russia actually was an imperialist country, but it was a peculiar situation. It was both an imperialist country and also completely dependent on foreign capital, French, Britain, Belgium, American capital. Now, the theory of the permanent revolution states that under modern conditions, in backward colonial and semi-colonial countries, the bourgeoisie is not able to play any progressive role. The bourgeoisie is not able to carry through the tasks of the bourgeois democratic revolution, say, I've mentioned some of them, and you can specify them if you like, its independence from foreign rule, national independence, the unification of the country in some instances, an agrarian reform, the destruction of feudalism and feudal relations, and, if you like, the conquest of democracy, that would be part of it, and of course, the modernization of the country. Now, under modern... these were tasks in the past that were carried out by the bourgeoisie. For example, the classical example would be France in the 18th century, the French Revolution, the great bourgeois revolution. But under modern conditions, you can look at any example you care to mention. The colonial bourgeoisie has never been able to carry through the anything resembling a bourgeois democratic revolution. And the reason for that is that the colonial bourgeoisie arrived in history too late. That includes the Russian bourgeoisie. They developed too late, and therefore they're completely dependent, first of all, dependent on foreign capital. It's particularly important in the colonial country. They're fused. The colonial bourgeoisie is dependent on foreign capital. It doesn't have an independent existence in that sense. And it's also tends to be fused with landlord interests. What you will find is in all these countries, the bourgeois are linked with a thousand links, not only to imperialism, but to feudalism. The capitalists own land, the landlords in turn own capital through the banks and so on and so forth. So you're talking about one reactionary oligarchic bloc. Therefore, Trotsky argued, that in countries like this under modern conditions, the historical task of the bourgeois democratic revolution can only be carried out by the proletariat, by the working class. Now, you could argue, well, the proletariat, it's all very well, but the proletariat in China was a minority. That's true. But the Russian proletariat was also a tiny minority. We can quantify that. In Russia before 1917, there were not more than 4 million industrial workers in a population of 150 million people. That's how backward Russia was. 10 million workers, if you include all sectors, railways, mines, and so on and so forth. Extremely backward. Much more backward than Pakistan at the present time. And yet in Russia, to use the expression of Trotsky, the working class put itself at the head of the nation, mobilized the peasantry, which is most important, of course. Peasantry must play a very important role in the backward country. Yes, but the working class must be in the leadership of that movement. They would mobilize the peasants, the intellectuals, the students, the urban petty bourgeois to a certain extent, behind the slogans, first of all, of the democratic revolution. Don't forget, the Russian Revolution took place on three slogans. Peace, bread, and land. Now, not one of those slogans is a socialist, has any socialist content whatsoever. They're bourgeois democratic slogans. And on the basis of mobilizing the masses around these slogans, the Bolsheviks took power. But once they came to power, it was quite clear, they couldn't stop halfway. Russian bourgeoisie is not capable of playing any progressive. So they expropriated the capitalists. And then, on the basis of a regime of workers' democracy, of Soviets, they began to move towards socialism. Let's put it that way. Now, in the case of China, there could have been the same development that took place in Russia. It was entirely possible. In the first Chinese Revolution, 1923 to 1927, first of all, the Chinese Communist Party was a sizable force. It's incredible how quickly they developed. It started as a very small group of students based abroad, people like Chou Enlai in Paris. Small group of students. But such were the conditions, the favorable conditions in China, of course, that also with the example of the Russian Revolution, which inspired people and acted as a pole of attraction, the Chinese Communist Party became a mass party, which could have taken power as the Bolsheviks took power. After the Bolsheviks only had 8,000 in February, I think the Chinese Communist Party, I'm speaking from memory, the figure would have to be checked, I think they had at least 50,000. 100,000, I'm not sure. But they were a sizable force, and they moved millions. Now, the problem was, unfortunately, the Chinese Revolution was developing at a time when the Russian Revolution was in decline, was in retreat. And Stalin and the bureaucracy were in the process of taking power. Trotsky was expelled in 1927. One of the issues, one of the big problems between Stalin and Trotsky was the Chinese Revolution, precisely. And the advice that Stalin and his ally Bukharin gave to the Chinese Revolution was a disaster. Although paradoxically, Stalin didn't want the defeat of the Chinese Revolution; he wanted it to succeed. But he gave it fundamentally false advice. And the advice was, he advised the Chinese communists to dissolve themselves into the Kuomintang, which is a nationalist bourgeois party led by Chiang Kai-shek. They went so far, as a matter of fact, putting forward the illusions of a progressive bourgeoisie, which did not exist in China. They tried to maintain that Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang was a progressive party, even compared to the British Labour Party, things of this kind. And unbelievably, Stalin actually put Chiang Kai-shek on the Executive Committee of the Communist International. I don't know if you know that. There's one vote against. But that was Trotsky's vote. He actually put Chiang Kai-shek in the leadership of the International. And the Chinese communists loyally carried out the instructions of Moscow. They joined the Kuomintang. And in 1927, Chiang Kai-shek butchered the Chinese communists. It was a terrible slaughter in Shanghai above all. Thousands and thousands of workers were tortured and butchered and beheaded and so on. And the Chinese Communist Party was destroyed. In the cities, it was destroyed. And therefore, the first Chinese Revolution was aborted because of the false policies of Stalin. Now, after this disaster, Mao Zedong led the remnants of the Chinese Communist Party. They had to flee to the villages. But they actually, first of all, linked up with bandits, by the way. There were even articles in the Comintern press which criticized them for being involved in bandit activities. But they did regroup under difficult conditions. They did regroup in the countryside. But they'd lost the base in the towns. Now, I won't go into all the details of what happened subsequently. The situation developed still further when Japan invaded China. I think in 1932, can you remember the actual date when they invaded? It was in the early 30s anyway. Japanese imperialism always wanted to conquer China. They weren't the only ones. The Americans also had designs on China, as we'll see in a moment. But the Japanese stepped in with extreme brutality. I mean, it's a terribly bloody episode. The rape of Nanking and so on. A terrible episode in Chinese history. And the Chinese communists put forward the idea, again under the influence of Stalin, of a united front with Chiang Kai-shek. They actually saved Chiang Kai-shek's life, you know, in 1934. The famous, the Xi'an incident, he was arrested by his own officers. So because Chiang Kai-shek, this reactionary gangster, was obsessed with defeating the communists, he didn't put up a serious fight against Japanese imperialism. And that was true all the time. He wasn't interested in fighting the Japanese, he was interested in fighting the Reds, in fighting the communists. To the extent that some of his own officers, I think they were from Manchuria, Manchuria was taken over by the Japanese, and they were discontented with the way he handled it, they actually arrested him. And the Chinese communists, Mao Zedong, under instructions from Moscow, demanded that he be released. And he was released. They would have lynched him otherwise. They'd have killed him probably. And in order to appease the Kuomintang, in order to appease Chiang Kai-shek, they actually, initially, they soft-pedaled on the agrarian reform, which is the fundamental question for the peasants. I won't go into all the details of the long march, which is an extraordinary thing, where they marched thousands of miles through difficult territory, always being attacked by the Kuomintang. But they did maintain their forces, and they began to develop, on the basis of the complete rottenness of the Kuomintang, the complete rottenness of the Chinese bourgeoisie, the inability to solve any of the problems. They were incapable even of conducting a struggle against the Japanese. Although theoretically they were allies, in point of fact, most of the real fighting against the Japanese was done by the communists, was done by the Red Army, by the partisans. Ted Grant always said that in many areas the Japanese only controlled the railway lines in the cities. They didn't control the countryside. The countryside was in the hands of the Reds. It was a very heroic struggle. You can say what you like about Mao Zedong, but it was a very heroic struggle that they carried out. And of course, the whole thing changed then with the Second World War, when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union. And for a period, they still maintained this fiction of a united front. It was more fiction than anything else. But once the war ended, oh, by the way, on the demonstrations of the Communist Party in Britain and other countries during the war, they carried four portraits. Do you know this? In Britain, they carried the red flag and the Union Jack and four portraits. Guess who? Stalin, Churchill, Roosevelt, and Chiang Kai-shek. Yes, they carried this as fact. They carried the portraits on demonstrations. The great Democrats fighting against fascism, which was a joke, because Chiang Kai-shek never conducted any serious struggle against Japanese imperialism. He's always more concerned with defeating the communists. Now, in 1945, the American imperialists dropped the atom bomb on two cities, mainly civilian cities, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, wiping out large numbers of men, women, and children in the most barbaric fashion. This atom bomb was not intended for the Japanese. The Japanese were already in the process of suing for peace, of surrendering. They were already beaten when this occurred. This atom bomb was intended for the Russians as a warning. It's quite clear that once the Second World War was finished, a struggle was going to open up between American imperialism and the Soviet Union. 1945, the Red Army, the Russian Red Army, staged the biggest advance in military history, an astonishing advance. The imperialists, Hitler and Churchill and Roosevelt, all thought that the Russians were going to be quickly defeated. All their calculations were based upon this. And instead of being defeated, thanks to the nationalized planned economy, the Soviet Union staged the most fantastic military advance in history, and they ended up that they conquered half of Europe, practically, a third of Europe, the whole of Eastern Europe, and a big chunk of Germany. That's why Churchill and Roosevelt rapidly opened the second front in Europe, otherwise they'd have met the Red Army on the Channel, on the English Channel. What people don't know, however, is that in 1945 there was another. Once they defeated Hitler, they staged another massive advance in the east. People don't know about this, in Manchuria. They knocked the stuffing out of the Japanese. There's a big Japanese army in Manchuria, and the Russian Red Army knocked the stuffing out of them. They completely smashed them. And the Red Army was advancing in the direction of Japan, by the way. That was the problem. That was the concern of the American imperialists. The Russians might have taken Japan as well. So at this stage, anyway, the American imperialists had designs on China. The fact of the matter is that they wanted to turn China into a semi-colony. They had nicely worked out. Once the Japanese were defeated, they were going to move into China and take over its fantastic wealth and turn the people into colonial slaves yet again. And of course, they had an agent, a faithful agent in the person of Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang. Initially, there were supposed to be peace negotiations between the communists and between the Red Army and Chiang Kai-shek, which was a joke. In reality, the Americans were pumping in. The Americans were supposed to be arranging peace negotiations, and they were pouring in not men. Now, this is an important point. We must ask ourselves the question: how is it possible? Two questions. First of all, how is it possible that the Chinese Revolution succeeded? I mean, after all, from a military point of view, they were far inferior, both in numbers and arms and so on, far inferior to the nationalists. Secondly, the nationalists had behind them the might of American imperialism. How could a guerrilla army succeed in taking power? The first answer is that the superiority, really speaking, is on paper. Because it's not enough to have tanks and guns and aeroplanes, you've got to have men to use them. You know, I will deal with the methods which Mao Zedong used in a moment. But one of the factors, one of the most important factors here, was the fact that after a bloody world war in which the Americans suffered a lot of losses in Asia, the American people, and above all the American soldiers, would never have been prepared to fight another war in China against the communists. It wasn't possible. They could not intervene. They couldn't, neither the British nor the Americans, they couldn't intervene against either the Soviet Union, which was they wanted to do, They couldn't organize another war against the Soviet Union in 1945 with heavens above, after the World War allegedly against fascism. And they could not, certainly the Americans couldn't intervene in China. Not physically, they couldn't send troops. They did send stacks of money, aid, equipment, guns, bombs, tanks, planes, you name it. Chiang Kai-shek had all these things. Which, by the way, the Americans later got some of their weapons back in Vietnam, where they were used against them, because all this weaponry fell into the hands of the Red Army in a couple of years. But originally, on paper, the Chiang Kai-shek had crushing advantage. By the way, Stalin played a very, to put it mildly, ambiguous role in all this. He still maintained contact, even at this stage, with Chiang Kai-shek. As a matter of fact, Mao Zedong, to one of his biographers, he complained bitterly many years later that the last ambassador to leave Chiang Kai-shek's government when he was overthrown was the Russian ambassador. To the very end, they had Stalin's advice to Mao Zedong was not to take power. He didn't believe that he could take power. He said so in public. He didn't believe that the Chinese Communists had any chance at all of taking power. And his advice was to form a coalition government with Chiang Kai-shek, which Mao was not very convinced about. You know, he's had plenty of experience of Chiang Kai-shek. But anyway, they had to go through this farce of negotiations. And they were negotiating to organize a coalition government and to have peace and capitalism and so on. Mao Zedong, it's an actual fact, at that stage, had illusions in America. He had illusions in America that the Americans were going to help him, originally. He soon learned differently to that. He soon learned the real situation. The real situation, the Americans, behind this image of peace and so on, were pumping in guns and weapons and money into the hands of Chiang Kai-shek, who prepared a counter-revolutionary offensive, I think it was in the summer, certainly in 1946 anyway. I forgot the actual month, it doesn't matter. 1946, Chiang Kai-shek organized a massive attack. By the way, the Russians occupied Manchuria, and initially they did give some assistance to the Red Army, to the Chinese Red Army, because they had to give some assistance to the Chinese comrades. But then Stalin said, oh no. Chiang Kai-shek objected. He had nothing in Manchuria. The communists had a base in Manchuria. He had nothing in Manchuria. And he demanded the right as the legal government of China to occupy Manchuria. The Russian Red Army allowed him to occupy a number of strategic points, which wasn't very good from the standpoint of the Chinese communists. He allowed them to occupy certain points. And Chiang Kai-shek was demanding that the Russian army should not move out, because he was terrified if the Russian army was to move out, the communists would immediately move in. And he wanted them to delay it, to allow him a chance to take over Manchuria. And the Russians said, okay, we'll wait. And they did wait. And while they were waiting, they stripped the whole of Manchuria of all its industry, railways and everything, carted it back to Russia. Which again wasn't very nice from the standpoint of the Chinese, from Mao Zedong and so on. And under these circumstances, the nationalists staged a massive counter-offensive. And initially, the Red Army retreated, and the people were saying in the West, oh, they're going to be defeated, they're going to be smashed. That was the position of the American SWP and Cannon and so on. You know? That Mao Zedong they were arguing that Mao Zedong was going to capitulate to Chiang Kai-shek. Why? Because Chinese Stalinism is counter-revolutionary. And Max Sachmann, the revisionist, as Ted always used to say, he had a group in America, he had them laughing and rolling about laughing in the corridor, but he cracked a joke. He said, oh yes, he said, Mao Zedong, it's true, Mao Zedong wants to capitulate to Chiang Kai-shek. There's only one problem, he can't catch up with him. He's running away. He can't catch up with him in order to capitulate to him. You know? It was nonsense. Mao Zedong had no intention of capitulating to Chiang Kai-shek, but he understood that because they were under inferior conditions, they couldn't hold the towns and cities, so they abandoned them. And they didn't run away, they staged an organized strategic withdrawal. It was quite masterly. And you have to give Mao Zedong his credit. He staged, in effect, a classical peasant war. Now, you must understand that there's a long history of peasant wars in China, going back thousands of years. Mao Zedong staged a classical peasant war based on an agrarian revolution. While they had this nonsense of a united front with Chiang Kai-shek, they actually moderated, they abandoned the slogan of land to the peasants, actually, for some years. they lowered the position to the position of lowering the rents and the things of that kind. It was a very moderate program. But in 1946, I think it was, they changed all that. And they said, right, the gloves are off, we're going to fight now to the end. The slogan is land to the tiller, land to the peasants. And that was a large part of their success. Patel used to say that in every village where the Chinese Red Army entered, the PLA, it was the Poor People's Liberation Army, whenever they entered the village, they would shoot the landlord if they could get hold of him. Normally he would escape. They would distribute all the land to the peasants, except for a number of plots which they would leave alone. They would leave they would reserve a number of plots, reserved for the soldiers in Chiang Kai-shek's army, who were peasants as well. When they captured, as an actual fact, when they captured when the nationalist forces captured communists, they would murder them, torture them, and murder them without any contemplation. They staged terrible atrocities, by the way, in the areas that they occupied, Chiang Kai-shek's army. They launched a slogan of burn, loot, and kill. That was the slogan. Burn, loot, and they did that. Like the Japanese. They behaved no differently than the Japanese. And that, of course, again, turned the population against Chiang Kai-shek and pushed them behind the communists, behind Mao Zedong. Whenever the communists caught prisoners from the nationalist army, they didn't execute them, they didn't ill-treat them, they didn't beat them. They gave them food, they looked after them if they were ill or wounded, and they gave them political lectures. And they showed them that the land reform, that they were giving land to the peasants. And then they released them. Go back, home. Which they did, and of course, whenever they went back, they carried the message with them. With the result that, as Ted used to say, Chiang Kai-shek's army had the biggest desertion rate of any army in history. It just melted away. After the initial success, they had some initial success, because Mao Zedong ordered a strategic withdrawal from the cities, based himself in the countryside where they were strong, gathered the new forces. He had an unlimited resource of recruits on the basis of the land, giving the land to the peasants. And therefore the peasants would fight like tigers once it was a question of the land. And therefore, although they took big losses, the Red Army took big losses, it didn't matter, they would replace them with new recruits all the time. The unlimited resource of manpower. And therefore, the Mao Zedong's army, which originally was in a minority when compared to Chiang Kai-shek, grew rapidly. And Chiang Kai-shek's army began to melt away like snow. It just melted away. And then, of course, Mao Zedong went on to the offensive. By 1947, they'd already gone on to the offensive. By 1948, they'd virtually defeated, by the end of 1948, they'd defeated the nationalists. You know, they moved from north to south. And finally, they occupied Peking, Beijing as it's called. I think it was called Beiping at the time. Beiping. They changed the name when they occupied it. And of course, they took power. Now, the question is this. Trotsky, before the war, posed the question. He pointed out that there'd be many peasant wars. If you look at the history of China, it's quite interesting that there'd be a dynasty in power, and every so often there'd be a peasant revolt. And there'd be a civil war and a peasant revolt. The peasant army would conquer the towns. The leaders of the peasant army would enter the towns. And all that would happen is that they would fuse with the Mandarin caste, with the ruling class, if you like, and form a new dynasty. That's all. And the whole process would be repeated and repeated in a never-ending cycle, and nothing would change. There'd be no real change in Chinese society. Now, before the war, Trotsky posed the question, what would happen when the Chinese Red Army would enter the towns? He said, that's the decisive question. The peasant army, incidentally, the peasantry, what is the role of the peasantry in all this? Now, Marx and Engels explained, and Lenin and Trotsky also explained, that the only really revolutionary force in society is the working class, the proletariat. Why is this? Why is it the proletariat, not the peasantry, or the lumpen proletariat, or the students? You know, is there something special about workers? Well, not individual workers, of course. There's nothing special about an individual worker. But there is something very special about the proletariat as a class, because of its role in production, particularly large-scale industrial enterprises. The conditions of life in large-scale enterprises create, because it's social production. Peasant production is not. Peasant production is individual production. They're small property owners. And even a landless peasant, although he may be formally a rural proletariat, what does he want? He wants a plot of land. He's aspiring to become, normally, he aspires to become a small proprietor. Marx says in the 18th Brumaire that there's no more connection between the peasants than potatoes in a sack. He's not an individual proprietor. As a matter of the peasantry is the social class which is least likely to adopt a socialist consciousness. It is possible under certain circumstances, but it's the least likely. The working class is the only class which because of the conditions of production which it is participating in, has a natural, innate tendency to adopt a collectivist and socialist consciousness. You look at the methods of struggle of the working class, the strike, the general strike, insurrection, and so on. These are collective methods of struggle. Whereas guerrilla war, terrorism, and assassination, these are the methods of the petty bourgeoisie and the lumpen proletariat and the peasantry, not the working class. Now, the peasantry cannot actually carry through a socialist revolution. Nowhere in the whole volume of Marxist literature will you find any reference by Marx, Engels, or Lenin that suggests any such thing. It's such an aberration. It's a ridiculous idea. On the contrary, the peasantry and the peasant army, it's a very malleable class. It can be easily influenced by demagogues. The peasant army is the classical instrument of Bonapartism. It was the classical instrument of the original Bonapartism, Napoleon Bonaparte. And therefore Mao Zedong based itself on the peasant army, or more correctly, an army composed of ex-peasants, ex-workers, and ex-Marxists. Ex, because they're Stalinists. A distorted conception of Marxism and socialism. And using the peasant army as a battering ram, they smashed the old state apparatus. It wasn't difficult. Because the old state apparatus of the Chinese bourgeoisie was an escape from the corrupt dissolution. And they smashed. And now what you have to understand is, Engels explained, and Lenin repeated, that in the last analysis, the state is armed bodies of men in defense of property. That's what this is. What state existed in China in 1949, when Mao entered Beijing? What state? The only state that existed was the Chinese Red Army, the Peasant Army, controlled by the Chinese Stalinists. The Stalinists, it's true, Mao Zedong had the perspective of capitalism, it's a fact, and actually formed a coalition government, not with the Kuomintang. The Kuomintang fled for their lives. Chiang Kai-shek fled to the island of Formosa, which today is called Taiwan. And from this tiny island, he was declaring himself that I'm the real China for about 50 years, 30 years at least. They had a seat on the General Council, Taiwan, Formosa. And they said, we are China. Whereas, of course, the 1 billion people on the mainland were not supposed to exist. They fled, but of course, when he fled, he took the treasury with him. Actually, he took all the loot, he took millions of dollars with him. And they had a very nice life in Taiwan, supported by the Americans. And with Chiang Kai-shek fled the land, the bulk of the landlords, the bankers, the capitalists, and so on. They fled. And therefore, Mao Zedong formed a coalition government with who? Not with the Chinese bourgeoisie. The Chinese bourgeoisie fled. The Chinese bourgeoisie was in Taiwan. They fled for their lives. He formed a coalition government, the same as the Republicans and Stalinists in Spain in 1936. They formed a coalition government, not with the bourgeoisie, but with the shadow of the bourgeoisie. The bourgeoisie was not there. Now, I have a book which I will publish, an article on the website. Very interesting book by an American journalist called Doak, who was present in China at the time. The name of the book is China on the Eve of Communist Takeover. It's an interesting book. A series of articles, actually. which he wrote at the time. And he gives details about these so-called parties that ended the school. And it's quite a joke. I can't remember all the names. The Kuomintang's People's Democratic League and things like this. It's about six people. Nobody's ever heard of these parties. So-called parties. They're based in Hong Kong. And he offered them positions in the government. They came, and they came running, of course. But these were not parties at all. They represented nobody. The only serious party in this coalition was the Communist Party. And the Communist Party controlled, that's to say the Stalinists, controlled the state. They had the Red Army, which they could use for any purpose at any time. They had the police, they had the secret police, they had the bureaucracy, they had everything under their control. Now, when they entered the cities, by the way, and again, the same Dorcas, I'll produce the statements, which is the issue. A genuine Red Army, a genuine workers' army, if it entered the towns, what would it say to the workers? In a revolutionary struggle against Chiang Kai-shek, what would you say? You'd have strikes, and general strikes, and demonstrations, set up Soviets, take workers' control. Not a bit, quite the opposite. All the declarations and appeals of the Chinese Red Army to the workers and the students is stay at your place of work, do not strike, do not demonstrate, do not move, remain calm until and await until the People's Army takes control and tells you what to do. And in cases where they disobeyed this, again, it's specifically stated, anyone that causes disorders or strikes or so on will be punished, and they were punished. In other words, what Mao did, first of all, in Bonaparte's time, he used the peasant army to crush Chiang Kai-shek's army, yes, he did that. And then he leaned on the bourgeoisie, or rather the shadow of the bourgeoisie, to put down any movement, any independent movement of the workers and students and so on. There was a big student movement, it all stopped by the Stalinists. Prior to that, there had been a mass movement of the students against the imperialists. Put a stop to that. So the workers were put in their place, very firmly. Mao Zedong installed himself, the Stalinists installed themselves in positions of power. But of course, Mao Zedong took, once he was in power, he took one look at the situation. The country was in a complete mess with rampant inflation, hyperinflation, industry was in a state of collapse, mass unemployment and so on. Mao Zedong's main intention was to develop China as a modern industrialized nation. He took one look at the situation and he said, well, this is hopeless. You could see the absolute rottenness of the Chinese bourgeoisie, completely incapable of playing any progress at all. And therefore, it was quite a simple operation. He had power in his hands. All he had to do was to lean on the working class, who obviously would support this, to expel the bourgeois from the government, arrest them and so on, and expropriate not just the land but the industry as well, and the banks and the property of the imperialists. Now, Ted used to say he did it in quite an amusing way. He didn't even bother to nationalize the foreign companies. All he did was introduce a series of laws. It's a bit similar to Chavez in Venezuela in that sense, although he hasn't gone nearly as far. But introduced labor laws and so on health and safety and profits and taxes and so on, which made it impossible for them to operate. Whereupon they just left. He said, okay, this is nationalized. It's ours. And the imperialists could do nothing about it. They were impotent. They could rant and rave and so on, they couldn't do anything about it. The British capitalists are very good at pretending to have a victory when they've had a defeat. Look at Dunkirk. The biggest most horrible defeat in the history of the British Army, and they presented this great victory because they managed to scramble off the beaches and escape with their lives. And that was only because Hitler allowed them to do it, because he didn't want to crush the British at that time. He wanted them to do a deal with them, which he didn't succeed in. The British actually, there was a warship called HMS Amethyst. I remember when I was young, when there's a film, The Amethyst Incident. Mm. Oh, and it's presented as a big... What's the success? The big deal was they actually escaped along the Yangtze River without being blown up by the Chinese Red Army. They escaped by the skin of their teeth. They escaped. And this is presented as a... He'd made a film about it. Just imagine the cheek of these people. It's astonishing. The British are very good at that. But the fact of the matter is the imperialists could just look upon this with impotent rage. They couldn't do anything about it. They had to stand by while all their property was expropriated. It was now expropriated everything, and then organized what? Not socialism, of course. Not even the democratic worker state as Lenin and Trotsky had in Russia in 1917, 1918. No. He copied, he imitated faithfully the model, the only model that they had, I suppose, which was Stalinist Russia. That's another factor in the equation. So if you were to ask how these developments could take place, we will sum up the argument, if you like. First of all, the inability of the imperialists to intervene. They couldn't intervene. That was a big factor. Secondly, the complete rottenness of Chinese capitalism, which meant that it was incapable of playing any kind of progressive role. For example, they were incapable of carrying through an agrarian reform in 20 years. Chiang Kai-shek was in power for 20 years and couldn't carry through any of the tasks of the bourgeois revolution. Mao Zedong did that. The Chinese Revolution did that, like that. They destroyed feudalism, which of course is... The other point is the existence of a powerful Stalinist totalitarian state next door, which of course they modeled themselves. In other words, the Chinese Revolution began where the Russian Revolution ended. The Chinese Revolution never went through a phase of workers' democracy, Soviet democracy, as was the case in Russia. It was a deformed Bonapartist struggle from the beginning. And of course certain things flow from that. You know, a police state, dictatorship, bureaucracy, all kinds of negative things, all that is true. Having said that, I'll go back to what I said in the beginning. Despite everything, despite anything that can be said about the Chinese Stalinists and Mao Zedong and so on, the Chinese Revolution of 1947, I repeat, was the second greatest event in human history. Why do we say this? Well, just think for a moment what China was like before 1949. It's a country of millions of people in which for hundreds of years, for generations at least, the Chinese people were the pack horses of imperialism. They were slaves. Without any rights, they weren't treated as human beings. They were exploited, robbed, plundered, systematically humiliated for generations. 1949 put an end to that. Chinese people for the first time came on the stage of history as a great nation with all their pride and skills and abilities, which now of course the whole world can see. Secondly, let's pose the question negatively. What would have happened if Mao Zedong had been defeated, if the revolution had been defeated? China undoubtedly would have been again a semi-colony of imperialism. The people again would be reduced to the role of colonial slaves. And as for this cynical hypocrisy, this argument, oh, the struggle was between democracy and communism. What sort of democracy did China have under Mao Zedong, under Chiang Kai-shek, I beg your pardon? It was a vile, brutal, bloody, tyrannous police state and a dictatorship, and that's what they would have had with interest if he would have succeeded. And therefore, that's just nonsense. No, it was a tremendous progressive thing. First of all, they achieved national independence for China. Genuine national independence for the first time in hundreds of years. All the stain and the humiliation of colonial domination was eliminated. Secondly, they carried out a thorough agrarian revolution. They shot the landlords, actually. Lots of them. After 1949. They broke the back of feudalism in China. Feudalism, which had dominated China for so long, was finished. This is surely a colossal achievement, a colossal advance. And last but not least, they broke with capitalism, not just with landlordism, but also with capitalism, expropriating the land, the banks, the industries and so on, and instituting, although it was on a caricature model, if you like, of Stalinism, nevertheless, it achieved colossal results. And China was transformed. Within a decade or so, it was transformed from a backward country to an industrialized state. They overtook Britain a long time ago. Under Mao Zedong, they'd overtaken Britain in absolute terms, not in relative terms, of course. And that, by the way, is the basis for China's present successes. The fact that they were able to educate a formerly illiterate nation, to build schools, universities, hospitals, and all the rest of it. And therefore, it was, and by the way, if you want proof of this, just compare China to India. India was independent approximately at the same time, 1947, I think it was. Approximately, a little bit before China. It's sufficient to compare the two nations even to this day to see the poverty, the suffering, the degradation, the illiteracy, the diseases that exist in India. It's true there's been a limited development of capitalism in some areas of India. But there's no comparison between that and the enormous successes of China, the literacy program. They've got a literate population, skilled working class, you know, marvelous achievements and a strong industrial base, of course. Which now, of course, is confronted with the question of capitalism. It's a separate item for discussion, we won't go into that. But the idea that you could you can drag the Chinese people into a new form of slavery, which is capitalism, I don't think so. The Chinese people are going to resist. There'll be enormous class struggles. Already there have been some strikes taking place in China. But there is no way that the Chinese people will accept going back to this position. Again, of working like animals in capitalist factories for capitalist exploitation. And therefore, I will just finish by quoting not Karl Marx, and not Trotsky, and not Mao Zedong. Somebody I don't usually quote is Napoleon. You know what Napoleon said about China? A long time ago, he said the following very interesting thing. He said, China is a sleeping giant. He says, the day that giant stirs, the world will tremble. The world will tremble. And I'll say this. I agree with what Napoleon said, with one small amendment. The Chinese proletariat is a sleeping giant. It's grown enormously over recent years and decades. Chinese proletariat is one of the strongest in the world. It's a sleeping giant, yes, but that giant is going to awake to the traditions of 1923 and 1927. And therefore, I would say that when that giant awakens, which it will do, the whole world will tremble, and the Chinese proletariat will show us all how it's done. And I'll finish on that.